Welcome to the Independent Kiwi Show. I'm your host, Paul Carruthers, and I'm talking with Vinnie Eastwood, my guest today. And we're going to be talking about the South Canterbury Finance trial and its outcome and what that means for New Zealand, as well as other current events and topics that are currently in play in the New Zealand news and obviously the world news. And later on in the show, we're going to be talking to Dr. Rima Labeau, who's going to be talking to us about the rise of fascism and what it means and why people are behaving the way they are socially around governments that are becoming increasingly fascist. So that should be an interesting conversation, but... right now, let's get started and talk about South Canterbury Finance, Vinnie.
I think this is a good idea, and also I wanted to talk around the more or less the lack of interest about the South Canterbury Finance by the general public, because if you go up to them and you say, hey, look, there's some scumbaggery going on with South Canterbury Finance, I'm one person saying one thing versus the million people who've said a million things through the mainstream media who they're far more likely to believe, even though they didn't have any evidence for any of their claims whatsoever. And I think that this is actually a microcosm of how New Zealanders perceive the news. Would you agree, Paul?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, what you've just described is a phenomenon that occurs when people basically don't believe something unless they read it in the news, in a mainstream newspaper headline. And that's exactly what's happened in this case. So people suspend disbelief. They wait for, I guess, in inverted commas, official confirmation to support what it is that, you know, they wait for official confirmation to support the views that people like you and I have about it. So they won't take it from people like you and me because we're not regarded as official, or, you know, we're not appointed by some massive corporation to sort of speak about the subject. So that they even a lot of sort of hardened activists and people who claim to be critical thinkers actually don't realize the degree to which they fall into this trap, that ultimately they still sort of secretly wait for official confirmation by the newspapers or by the TV news or whatever to tell them that what Vinnie Eastwood is saying or what Paul Carruthers is saying is in fact correct. And so this is the dilemma we're in. We sort of bang away on a subject sometimes for years and years and years, and you can present enormous amounts of evidence, but still a lot of people, they wait for that headline to tell them, oh yes, that was in fact correct, or that guy was in fact correct, or and that's sadly how it works. And so far, the simple fact of the matter is with the South Canterbury Finance trial, mate, and the whole carry on with Alan Hubbard and that has been the massive publishing and broadcasting power that the media has got has won the argument, because
I explain something? Because as an activist, I tend to use megaphones. And when somebody comes up to me in the middle of a protest without a megaphone and tries to argue with me, I argue back with them through the megaphone and I win.
That's exactly like trying to deal with the media in reverse, mate. That's exactly what happens, is you come out and say, well, you know, X, Y, Z, and here's a bit of evidence to support that. And, of course, the more critical thinkers on your Facebook friends list, and the more reasonable people out there go, yeah, that's worth some thought, that. Gee, I hadn't looked at it that way. Gosh, that's actually really compelling. And they'll go away and think about it some more. But unfortunately, the majority of people just go, oh, yeah, it could be true. Yeah, but yeah, we'll wait for official confirmation.
Well, I think we're just lazy. We're just freaking lazy. That's it. I mean, we don't want to research into things. We don't want to watch a documentary about it or listen to a long interview. In fact, whenever you want to explain something to somebody, they kind of don't get the idea that not everything can be summed up in a 30-second nutshell for you and keep all the proper information in there that you need in order to actually understand the situation. And ultimately, people are used to watching television news of the few seconds of a soundbite, and that's all you're their understanding. And what totally. This, I believe that this has actually trained the minds of our countrymen, Paul, to ignore largely any information about anything that's contrary to their beliefs, particularly if what's contrary to their beliefs takes more than a minute of their time in order to investigate.
This is, you have just hit the nail on the head, and this is why we're in the situation we're in, where a lot of people are running around like headless chickens as the chickens of self-interest come home to roost in all around the world. And people are increasingly being squeezed out to the margins and wondering why it's happening. Well, I'll tell you why it's happening, because very few of them want to think. What they want to do, and if you look at the way people behave around elections, they do it here, they do it in the United States, they do it all around the world. They're constantly trying to elevate other people to do their thinking and their decision-making for them. Right, they're constantly looking for that one person or that group of people who they think are just ideal to run their lives and run the country and answer all the questions and make lots of soothing, reassuring noises when life gets scary and dangerous. They want someone to make lots of reassuring noises and tell them ultimately what they want to hear. And that's effectively what politics is built on. Right, modern day politics has become built on that, and it's become built on it to the degree where we now have massive corporations funding political parties, right, to tell people largely what they want to hear, because we have become lazy and consumerist and obsessed with celebrity, and you know, our whole culture has become really quite narcissistic, and guess what, the politicians who support that, the politicians who, you know, convince people that that is the ideal lifestyle, that's the way to go, they're the ones who get the most votes. Look at John Key, classic example. And to my friends, you know, and the proof of what I'm saying here, Vinny, right, is that I've got my friends, I can imagine some of my friends listening to this show going, oh, but hang on a minute, I can't stand John Key, I didn't vote for John Key. Ah, yes, but I watch you, most of you, time after time after time, looking to another political leader instead to provide you with exactly the same reassuring answers. I mean, if you know, half of my people on my friends list were doing it only a matter of weeks ago with David Cunliffe. Wouldn't hear a bad word about the guy. Well, how does that make them any different, right, to the people that supported John Key? They're going out and they're basically setting up the same kind of future mistake. They're trying to set up the same kind of paradigm, just in the form of another person, right? And they're missing the point. The point is, you save the world, right, and your own life, and you improve your own life by developing critical thinking skills and not needing to have the answer to something in 3.8 seconds flat.
It's patience, really, and I think it's almost like we've been... It reminds me of a film called The Island, where they have a whole bunch of people that are cloned, and there's a scene in it where he says that basically these people are like children, educated to the level of a 15-year-old, and they don't question their reality, they stay within the program, and they are much easier to control that way. And I think this is actually the way the media works specifically, and indeed there was a study done on mainstream media and the vocabulary that's being used. And it is a 12-year-old vocabulary, at least in the New Zealand Herald. Now, I think that if you're capable of keeping a population in the mindset of children, then why is it any surprise that they clamour for an adult to say solve all their problems for them?
Absolutely. You know, a lot of people don't understand the degree to which they react to things without actually thinking. Without actually applying critical thought to what they're being told, a lot of people just take it as given. If they read it in a newspaper, they just take it as given that it's the truth.
That's right. Now, we're being joined by Dr. Rima Labo from the Natural Solutions Foundation.
Welcome, Dr. Rima.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. I'm really glad to be here. I was listening as you were talking, and I couldn't resist adding something, if I may.
Sure.
By training, I am a psychiatrist. I'm a drug-free psychiatrist. I have never used drugs on anybody. But I do know a lot about thinking and processing. And as you were speaking, you were absolutely correct, but I wanted to add another characteristic to immaturity, or conversely, another characteristic to maturity. The immature thinking process is built around certainty. Things are this way or that way. They're good or bad. You're protected, you're not protected.
So in other words, the left-right paradigm.
And there is no uncertainty that can be tolerated, whereas mature thinking can tolerate uncertainty and, in fact, can tolerate ambiguity so that several different truths can be held about the same thing at the same time. What do I mean by that? If I love you and I have the maturity of a four-year-old, I love you, and if you do anything bad, then I hate you and I don't love you anymore. But if I have the maturity of an adult, then I love you, but I really hate what you just did. And we're going to have to work on this because this is a problem for us in this way or for you. So I hate that. I love this. I admire this. I really can't stand the other. But it all goes into a cohesive framework in which people can tolerate the ambiguity and the uncertainty of not having everything absolutely like the television show. It's scary now, it's all better now, and so on. And so one of the things that's really, really upsetting about the media education, which is where most people get most of their education, is that it doesn't tolerate ambiguity. It doesn't allow not only for critical thinking, but for complex thinking.
And that, I couldn't agree more.
Part of that is that we don't read literature anymore. Because what is literature about? I happen to have a literature degree from undergraduate school. And I think it was probably the best preparation for being a psychiatrist that I could have had. Because literature is about holding separate affects, separate perceptions at the same time. Otherwise, it's just simple storytelling.
It's interesting you say that, Dr. Rima. What was going through my mind? I've actually, my personal journey over the last few years has actually been about learning to come to terms with uncertainty after being very frightened of it for a very long time. And I was very stuck in this or that, left or right. It had to be one or the other kind of mentality for a very big part of my life. And circumstances threw me into a set of situations over the last 3 or 4 years that have forced me to have to really learn to live with uncertainty and actually be comfortable with uncertainty. And I've sort of more or less mastered that now to the best of my ability. And in that process, I've been studying up on exactly the concepts that you're talking about. And what you just said resonated very, very strongly with me. And that is from my own direct personal and actually very recent experience. And one observation I'll make is that I'm not a particularly religious person, but there's an interesting thing in the Bible when they talk about revelations and all the rest of it and the end of the world and all these, you know, end time events that some people say that we're experiencing now. And there's a reference in the Bible about the meek inheriting the earth. In other words, after a big dust up, there's going to be a sort of a peaceful atmosphere, they say, and people are going to sort of repopulate the earth and it's all going to be lovely. And in my research, I actually decided I'd go and have a look at what does meek mean? Who are the meek? Who are these meek people that the Bible talks about that are going to inherit the earth? And my research actually took me to the Greek definition of the word meek. And the Greek definition of the word meek is means flexible or able to bend like a reed. In other words, able to deal with uncertainty and to deal with uncertain circumstances, but still to know what to do and how best to respond to those circumstances anyway. So that kind of ties in with what I got from what you were saying is the people who become increasingly flexible with their mind, the use of their mind and how they view life and how they deal with the circumstances around them, more adaptable is a good word as well. Adaptability appears to me, seems to me, to be the possible key to surviving well in increasingly uncertain times. What do you think?
Well, yes and no. Like everything else that human beings engage in, this one is also ambiguous. Because if you're too adaptable, you're a chameleon person. You're a psychopath. You become what the situation calls for, and you have no inner core that that gives you shape.
And so, in other words, you've just described most politicians.
Oh, all of them. absolutely. I've just described every psychopath on the planet. That's rather interesting, don't you think?
So
we can't be flexible where the moral fiber is laid. We have to be flexible where the intellectual capacity is played. You know, the word play is very interesting. In order to
Could you just explain what you meant by what you just said, that last bit about the moral intellectual? Could you just explain that in more detail?
I was hoping you would ask.
Yeah.
We either does have a moral fiber or we doesn't.
Okay.
You either have an inner core of values that must be expressed and must be lived in order for you to be comfortable in your own skin, or you don't.
Okay.
The less you have of that moral fiber, the more flexible you can be where you need to be inflexible, which is in that moral core. Think of it as a trellis on which the plant grows. Well, the plant can grow in this configuration or in that configuration, but it grows on the trellis, on the true inner self. Mm-hmm. Or it's just a floppy mass that creeps and crawls and invades wherever it can. Now, on the other hand, where the flexibility is necessary is where the intellectual connection between this and that and the other thing and how things work and are we certain that this is true and just how do we know that and possibly another interpretation might fit the facts better. The intellectual and emotional capacity to be flexible that you, Paul, were talking about. Very, very important. But if it's flexibility built around no inner moral sense, well, what do you have? You have sneaky capacity.
Let me ask you a question, Dr. Rima. How many people, in your experience as a psychiatrist, how many people do you believe are in touch with their core values? How many people have done the work necessary out there in society? What percentage of the people you see are really quite clear about what it is they value and what decisions they were willing to make around those values?
Almost nobody. But the people that I value as mentors, as friends, in this case as a spouse, as colleagues, for instance, Ralph Fusitola, the co-trustee of our Natural Solutions Foundation. These people are radiant beings because they are clear in who they are, what they are, and why they are doing what they are doing. And then they're incredibly flexible and creative.
Yep. Okay.
So not too many.
Right. So that I'm glad you said that, because that actually supports my observation about that exact subject, that I feel that a lot of people I know, just to start observing my Facebook friends list and how they respond to things, for instance, I feel that a lot of people I know are suffering from a malaise which comes from just a lack of awareness about what it is that really matters to them. And they not know what matters to them, but most people I know don't even understand why they don't even understand why that's the case, if you understand what I mean.
Absolutely.
Are you there?
I understand. Yep. Yes, I had to unmute.
Okay.
I understand exactly what you're saying, but remember, never underestimate the impact of fluoride. This is the kind of self-disconnect that fluoride creates.
Right.
Now, why is that important? Well, for exactly the reasons we're talking about.
Fluoride creates people who behave like children and passively just accept what they're told by the authorities and don't think to question it. That's ultimately what it comes down to, eh?
And there's a little bit more.
Mm.
It also reduces IQ. It also makes people infertile and gives them endocrine problems and so on, makes them apathetic. But what does it fundamentally do? Well, it calcifies the pineal gland. We lose our moral compass.
Right. Which doesn't necessarily turn us into murderers and rapists and thieves and that. But what it does do is it causes us to turn a blind eye when we see those kind of things being done, when things like that happen to other people, when people perpetrate those kind of activities against other people, we turn a blind eye to it. So that is a very direct explanation of apathy, really, isn't it?
We all know the history of fluoridation. We all know that the Germans learned it from the scientists in the political gulag of Stalin, where these intractably difficult political prisoners, who knew they were going to die anyway, couldn't be dealt with. They were so feisty and so oppositional. So they fluoridated them and they became apathetic. Okay, hey, like, whatever. You want me to freeze to death? I'll go freeze to death, whatever. And that was very useful. And the Germans fluoridated the prisoners in the concentration camps and the slave labor camps. And then toward the end of the war, the German citizenry said, wait a minute, we were supposed to win this war. Easily and quickly, what is happening? So the high command said, okay, well, we'll fluoridate everybody. And they said, okay, like, whatever, we'll just go on fighting, cool, okay. And it worked. And then those scientists came to the United States in Operation Paperclip and produced phony science. And the FDA said, on the basis of that phony science, cool, we'll fluoridate everybody. And
it's
working. And we have generation after generation of people whose genes have literally been impacted through the epigenomic information that we're learning about now, and they and their children's children have been changed.
Into very passive people, basically.
Into Americans, into Australians, into whatever.
Well, it goes on here too. I mean, most of our councils are putting fluoride in the water. There's an enormous debate going on about it in New Zealand at the moment. And so far, the government is winning it. Although, having said that, there's a lot of opposition to it as well.
When people oppose it, what are they opposing it on the basis of?
Health. Vinny's better positioned to actually answer that question than I am. Well, the question is, on what basis are people opposing fluoridation in New Zealand? What is the basis of their argument to oppose it?
I think the basis of the argument is that it's the worst neurotoxin known to man via clinical study, and it kills everything it touches, so it's probably not that great for your teeth. Unless, of course, you've got teeth in your stomach.
You're with the Independent Kiwi Show. I'm your host, Paul Carruthers, talking with Dr. Rima Lebeau. We're just going to take a break. You're with the Independent Kiwi Show. I'm your host, Paul Carruthers, talking with Dr. Rima Lebeau. We're talking about the effects of fluoridation on the population and just the general sort of reasons why apathy and other factors of human conditioning are giving rise to fascism in the world. So we've just finished talking about fluoridation and how the people who are campaigning against it, how they're actually pitching their argument. So what, in terms of trying to convince local bodies and councils and the people who actually go and put this stuff in the water, Dr. Rima, what is the best argument in your opinion to use in order to counter this issue, to actually get to have it stopped being put in the water?
if you continue to do this in the face of established scientific evidence about the negative impact, we the people will sue the shit out of you. We will go after your personal assets for willful negligence, and we will go after everything that this town, city, county, country, state has. And we will tie you up in court until you say, uncle. How about that?
Right. Yeah, well, that would be my approach. Why isn't it happening, though?
Because they're fluoridated.
It's kind of like a feedback loop, okay? Because if you put something in the water supply that dumbs people down, and then you try to enlighten people that there's stuff in the water supply to dumb them down, they're too dumb to get the stuff out of the water supply because they've already been dumbed down. It's like a catch-22. And also, the vast majority of fluoride, does it get drunk by people? No. It's actually an environmental pollutant as well, so the majority of it goes down our sink and goes into the water supply or into the ocean or anything like that. And this is an industrial poison. It's a level 6 biotoxin, which I think is the highest classification for biotoxins in the world. The vast majority of the fluoride that we receive in New Zealand comes from a Chinese phosphate fertilizer industry. Basically what they do is they crush rocks, shove a whole bunch of sulfuric acid through it, and then when all those chemicals and fumes and everything come up through the chimneys, they have these wet spray scrubbers which capture all that really toxic stuff, which is illegal to release into the atmosphere, and they collect them in large containers as a form of slurry. And it's incredibly expensive in order to get rid of that really highly toxic slurry, far more expensive than the profits that you can get from making phosphate fertilizer in a lot of cases. So what they have to do is they have to find some way of selling it, because under I think it's Uniform Commercial Code, if you sell an item that is toxic waste because you sold it, it is no longer classified under commercial code as toxic waste. It becomes classified under commercial code as a product. Now, it is illegal to dump toxic waste in the water supply, but it ain't illegal to dump a product into it.
That's really concerning. So there needs to we need to look at how the law is structured around that and look at changing it as well. But going back to Dr. Rima, I want to ask you a question about the future. As an experienced, qualified psychiatrist, what I'd like to ask you is, if we have to take as a given the things that are happening now around fluoridation and what the effect that it's had on populations and where people are at psychologically, that if we take that as a given and we look at everything that's happening in the world now in terms of the increased conflicts, the Ebola issue, and all of these potential markers, these indicators, which are suggesting very strongly that we're heading into a period of history where we're going to have increased government controls, increased surveillance over populations, all these justifications, you know, that Ebola and these wars and that are going to be used as justifications for all these increased surveillance and increased controls and, you know, all these issues we're heading into. What is your prediction? What do you think, based on your experience with dealing with people, how are people likely to react and behave and respond to these increasing, these situations which are just sort of increasing?
I think that depends on you, Paul, on you, Vinny, excuse me, on me, on the other activated people. Yes, we're activists, but we're activists because we're activated. If we do our job well, then we reach out to people wherever they are at that moment, and we activate them. We reach their hearts, we reach their funny bones, we talk about the lighter side of genocide, we scare the crap out of them with sound data. What?
Oh, I'm loving what you're saying. It resonates so strongly with me.
We give them the reason to reclaim their full humanity. And that reason has to do with the fact that human beings are, in many ways, tribal or pack animals.
Yeah, that's true.
And so when we are alone, we don't do our full humanness very well. Doesn't mean that we don't need privacy and introspection time, But it's a balance. It's a dance between the outer and the inner, just as we were talking earlier about a dance between the flexible and the inflexible. So we have to form communities where people can reach out, can explore new ideas, can explore uncertainty, can feel connected with people who are genuinely firm in their own inner self and who can engage in dialogue. Now, it may be electronic social media dialogue, it may be personal dialogue, but without dialogue, we don't develop. Without development, we decay. There are two fundamental movements in the universe. Think about it. One is expansive and the other is contractive.
Yes.
And when we
yes.
contract, not only do we cease to function well and do we age rapidly and collapse inward, biologically, physically, physiologically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, socially, psychologically.
It's called entropy, isn't it? It's entropy. Yep.
Indeed. When we expand, and that means taking in other people into our world, when we expand and are strengthened by those connections, then the energy that we develop, the entropy, is profound and brings about change.
That is, yeah, I agree with that. I mean, no one grows in isolation, do they? So, you know, I think, how do we, in your opinion,
because they're seeking communion, companionship. They're seeking community. One of the most basic things we do as human beings is eat together. And if we live 7,000 miles apart, then we make believe eat together.
Yep. Okay. How do we sort of reach people? How do you get people? What encourages the shift from apathy to engagement? What encourages people to move from a passive observation of a set of circumstances to actively engaging with those circumstances? What traditionally makes people make that shift? Is it crisis? What is it?
Crisis pushes them somewhere, but it may not push them to something effective. As you were asking that very, very important question, my answer was very simple, and it's love. It's love of what they need to protect. It's love of the order that they know and that they cherish. It's love of truth. It's the love that they feel that the leader has for the principle, for the outcome, for them. It's their love for each other, for the leader. And it can be expressed in a million different ways. I'm not talking about having an orgy. I'm talking about being connected through the deepest human capacity to be connected, which is through expansion and affiliation, which you might call love.
Right. Okay. It's... What do you think that this Ebola crisis is going to cause? What do you think the outcome is going to be for the United States, and obviously largely for the rest of the Western world as well, because it won't be limited to there? What do you think? What is your prediction for the way this is going to play out in the United States?
Extend your right hand 45 degrees from your body, horizontal to the ground. Extend your left hand 45 degrees from your body, horizontal to the ground. Mm-hmm. You're standing in the now. You are at these two divergent pathways. Now, down one road, if you will, there is a cataclysmic death, an engineered death, because this is a weaponized, patented virus. It has been worked on. Very interesting. Most people don't know, but when the virus was first recognized in the Netherlands in 1977, there were no biosecurity laboratories. They didn't have anything like the protective gear that we have and so on. And the blood of the nun who died in Kinshasa, the capital of the Democratic Republic of Congo, was sent by KLM, or via KLM, I should say, in a thermos with ice in the thermos and two glass test tubes with stoppers on them to the laboratory in Holland. And one of the test tubes had broken in this transit time. And so when they opened up the thermos, the bloody ice water, no longer icy, of course, splashed on them, on their hands, on their shoes, on the floor. And they didn't know what was in there. I mean, they knew it was blood, but they had no idea what the thing was that had killed the woman. Well, nobody got sick. The workers who cleaned it up didn't get sick. The scientists didn't get sick. Nobody got sick because it really wasn't all that infective. Well, the United States government took care of that. And now it is so incredibly infective that according to the United States Army Military Research Institute of Infectious Diseases at Fort Detrick, it is the most infective virus known, because not only can it infect you through your respiratory tract, airborne, but it can also infect you through any part of your body that it touches, your nose, your knee, the cornea of your eye, your earlobe, whatever it touches. And it is airborne, and according to this report, which is referenced along with a great many other scientific references in an article on just this on my website, Dr. Rima Truth Reports, that's D-R-R-I-M-A, truthreports.com, it is so incredibly infective and so increased in its lethality when it's airborne, when it's taken into the respiratory tract, that it is the most dangerous virus known. It's also a heavily patented virus, as we know. So down one hand is the path where 200 million, a billion, 2 billion people, 3 billion people die. And that is possible. The social disorganization, as the intentional depopulation proceeds, will be unlike anything humanity has ever seen, except perhaps the Great Flood, if there were a Great Flood, makes a good movie. And we're talking about total social disorganization and enslavement of the remaining few. Now, that's one path. That's the Agenda 21 wet dream. And it's
when you say enslavement, that occurs under the circumstances where the people actually willingly submit to that because they believe that it is necessary for their protection, and that's what we're heading into. You see, this is how I see the Ebola thing. If it is in fact a constructed crisis,
obviously it is,
it's constructed to actually get a reaction out of the population, and the reaction is, oh, save us. Please save us. We will do whatever.
I'm rolling up my sleeve. Put your stuff into my body. Vaccinate my child, please. That's the reaction while people die. And on the other hand, the other path is, based on what happened today in Sierra Leone, the possibility is totally different, because what happened today is that the president of Sierra Leone, President Koroma, and the Minister of Information, Honorable Alpha Kanu, made a statement to the world and to the people of their country. They said, and I quote, "Nano silver is a therapy for Ebola in our country. We do not have to follow the FDA." That's the Fraud and Death Administration. "We do not have to listen to what WHO says." President Koroma, about 3 weeks ago, kicked the head of station of WHO out of his country because WHO came to him and said, "You may not use nano silver here." And President Koroma said, "You are leaving my country now." I kicked him out. He said, we'll use what we like. Now, whose nano-silver is it? Mine. It's the Dr. Rima recommends 10 parts per million nano-silver, the same one that the FDA has written a warning letter telling us we may not tell people the benefits of. It's the same one that the New York Times and CBS and ABC and the Journal News and the Poughkeepsie Journal and NPR and every other mainstream media that could get its hands around this story savaged me for, calling me a spammer and a scam artist and a quack and a snake oil salesman. Snake oil is actually quite beneficial. It has a great many antioxidants and other useful factors, but never mind that. Actually, there was a brilliant paper looking at the biochemistry and physiology of snake oils. It's even better than flaxseed oil or hemp oil. Anyway, moving right along. And so I've been savaged. Our organization is being threatened with God knows what kind of legal consequences by the Fraud and Death Administration and the Federal Trade Commission. And yet, when we finally, after a great deal of effort, and after Air France did not deliver our express parcel of 200 bottles of nano-silver and 100 tubes of nano-silver gel for 6 weeks, and they lost our parcel and blah, 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 blah. Obviously, somebody from Geneva or the United States said, hey, don't deliver that parcel. Finally,
of course,
we found it by magic, if you will, and we put it in suitcases on an airplane going from the United States to Sierra Leone. We got it there, and within days, people stopped dying. Within days, people stopped dying. And so when the World Health Organization said, in this terrible time when there is nothing that works against Ebola, nothing, you can use anything, you can do any kind of human experimentation that you like. You don't need informed consent, use anything, except, of course, nano-silver, which works. So if people take this to heart, and I'd like to give my website where people can, in fact, get this particular nano-silver that was demonstrated by the United States Department of Defense Threat Reduction Agency, the DTRA, in work that was declassified in 2009, showing that the Ebola virus can't penetrate a cell once the 10 part per million nano-silver is present because it strengthens the immune system so powerfully. Well, if people take that seriously, then we move to quite a different future. We move to a future, and we're taking this to court, by the way, in the United States. We expect this to go to the Supreme Court. We move to a free future where the hidden and suppressed cancer cures can be spoken freely about and can be employed. We move to a time when the true value of nutrients, which is now forbidden under U.S. law to be spoken because it is illegal to say that a nutrient can diagnose, can prevent, can treat, can mitigate, or can cure anything, even if it can. We are compelled by the FDA and by its dependent agencies to engage in compelled lies, and we will not do that any longer. People can take back the language, they can take back the truth, they can take back their health. And imagine, just imagine, you asked what the future would be like. This same nutrient, and it's not a drug, this same absolutely safe nutrient also cures malaria. No more DDT spraying, no more vaccines against malaria. I'm not allowed to say cure, sorry, trolls, moles. That was a misstatement. It cures nothing. This supports the immune system so that the immune system cures the malaria. And that is indeed the fact. Let me just finish this one thought. Imagine just Africa without malaria, without schistosomiasis, without Lassa fever. Imagine a healthy Africa. What would the world geopolitical picture be like? Imagine that.
Infinitely more colorful and diverse, I would hope, and imagine. Interesting that I find it ironic that one of the best advertisements for silver, for colloidal silver, nano silver,
They're not the same. Sorry about that. We'll talk about that.
Explain the difference.
I will be happy to. And for more detail, please go to my website, www.drremastruthreports.com. There's a video there, right up on the top of the front page. Watch it, because it explains all of the types of silver. Now, colloidal silver could be pretty much anything suspended in water, any type of silver. Nanosilver, this particular nanosilver, and by the way, people say, oh, I can make that in my kitchen. Yes, you can. If you live in a metallurgical laboratory, which has high pressure tanks and 10,000 volts, if you have that, yes, you can. But most of us don't. Most of us take a couple of alligator clips and clip them to a bar of questionable purity silver and put it in water of questionable purity. And then we've got something. And we love it, and maybe it will cure this or that or the other thing. Maybe it will inactivate the Ebola. But for something that costs about 30 cents a serving, you really want to bet your life that your colloidal silver will do that? There is only one substance, to my knowledge, on the planet that has been shown to, that is safe, that has been shown to neutralize the Ebola virus through this immune support that I'm talking about. And it's this particular nanosilver, which is little spheres of metal, not ions, very important, little spheres of tiny, tiny, tiny bits of metallic silver at the right size, surrounded by a globe of a molecule linked together. And the molecule is Ag4O4. So it's four silver molecules and four oxygen molecules. Mm-hmm. And this globe actually supports the immune function so that the virus can't adhere to the cell and it can't penetrate the cell. If it can't penetrate, it can't replicate. The presence of a virus is not a disease, Paul. The replication of the disease of the virus causes the disease. No penetration, no replication. No replication, no disease.
It's interesting that what's your take on how the royal family, I mean, I was reading an article recently saying that they're actually the blue bloods because they eat with silver. They eat from silver and have done for generations or centuries, and that effectively has given them a lot of high silver content in their blood. And explains their longevity and general good health and so on. What are your thoughts about that?
This is a very old theory, and it may well be. We talk about babies born with a silver spoon in their mouth in the same context. Yeah. The Knights Templar, who ran the first hospitals in Europe, would serve the beggars, the poor, the indigent, on silver platters. Yeah. Then, when they were finished, the Knights Templars would eat the leftover food from these same silver salvers, with the same silver utensils. They didn't get sick. These people had every infectious and contagious disease roaming around Europe. They didn't get sick. One has to wonder whether it was because of the tiny bits of silver ingested. I suspect so.
Right. Oh, that's. I wondered if that was the case. Well, look, thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Rima. It's been fantastic talking with you. Very enlightening.
Thank you. May I give my website where people can, if they like,
absolutely,
find out more and can even purchase the silver?
Yep.
May I? To find out more, you want to go to http://// tinyurl.com/stop Ebola. To purchase the silver, if you should so choose, you would go to http://donate.drrimatruth.com. No www in that one.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Rima, and thank you very much for enlightening our audience. And hopefully we'll get to talk to you again as this story unfolds.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And you're with the Independent Kiwi Show. I'm your host, Paul Carruthers. We've been talking with Dr. Rima Lebeau about Ebola and about human conditioning, how humans react to their environment. Thank you for joining us.